What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Radio, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're so happy to be back with you for another week of talking movies here in Chicago. Connor, we did have to miss last week again. We've had a really bad streak.
Well, I mean, come on. The weather has been ridiculous. There's no way to not get sick. It's just creeping up on everybody.
Yeah, up and down. So there was a week prior, I mean, it was 2 weeks ago now, that I was sick. Couldn't do it. And then we did one last week.
And
then last week we were just like, can't do it again. Can't do it.
Can't do it.
Are you feeling better?
I'm feeling much better. Especially after that. That bump music was great.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you don't hear enough fretless bass on hip-hop tracks.
It's a full house right now. I'm really happy about it. And, you know, we haven't introduced them yet. So basically, they don't functionally exist in this room until I introduce them. They have not been named.
Right.
So therefore, the demons are at bay.
Mm-hmm.
If you name them, that's when they come into corporeal, you know, they have a corporeal form.
Yeah, they congeal.
They congeal.
So let's congeal them one at a time.
All right. First off, we've got a friend of the show. He's been on multiple times, and you know him and love him. He's from Soft Cage Films, and he's also a writer and director in his own right. Reverend David Holcomb. What's up, man?
Hey. Thought you never let me. Now I can talk.
So glad you could come back with us. Next to him, we have Spence Warren. He's a relatively new member of Soft Cage Films. He's going to sing his way into existence. Yes.
I'm here now.
You're a little flat. We're up here. You're down here.
It's like a Sesame Street way to manifest ones.
Yeah.
I like it. It's a little bit more fun for the kids.
Like an angelic sort of. That's
And then rounding us off, we've got Dustin Pueller. He is a writer and director and also the head of Ready Freddy Films. Welcome, Dustin.
Thank you. Thanks
and
for having
for
us.
Spence and Dustin, this is your first time on the show.
This is.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's great to have you.
We're in a deluxe office in the sky.
Yeah.
Right now. It's quite
lovely.
Are we
like 200 floors up?
Yeah.
300 million.
We are 45,000 miles above the earth, looking down on these people.
In a Zeppelin.
It's really great to get it's hard to, you know, get the background noise.
The flying buttresses are especially impressive.
We just had those installed last week, so.
Wow.
It's going to be great.
The air is really thin up here, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
So what we're going to be talking about is these guys have a, when you listen to this, they will have premiered a couple of films, three films. One of the filmmakers is not here, but it's going to be part of this event. It's a Soft Cage Films, Ready Freddy Films joint premiere. They're premiering three films. We've got Down the Rabbit Hole, written and directed by, how do you pronounce it? Adia Ivy. Down the Rabbit Hole, written and directed by Adia Ivy. The Year 4000, written and directed by Dustin Pueller. And Mandala, written by Heather Mingo and John Sutton, directed by Reverend David Holcomb. And we're really excited to have you guys. I guess we're on the precipice of this premiere. How are you feeling?
Pretty good. I mean, both of our films kind of came together in the last 24 hours.
Really?
Yeah, I feel like setting a premiere date is a good way to be like, all right, guys, there's a deadline. I'm not just making up a deadline for you. It has to be done. So.
Oh, yeah. I felt like I was doing one of those film races.
Yeah, yeah.
Doing it as quickly as
possible. Well, you were, like, shooting your film as of, like, last week.
Yeah.
So a little different for you.
Yeah, we're really going micro with this one.
How do you guys feel about that?
I really like it. I mean, we essentially, we just finished a feature, so we wanted to just do something fun, knock something out real quick, and, did something experimental this time. So, I haven't made anything like this, so I'm interested to see what people think.
Well, let's jump right into that. So, the name of your film, The Year 4000, you wrote it, you directed it, and it's got a pretty great premise. I love the kind of art that you have going around with it. I wish I could show you, but of course, we're on a podcast, and that kind of limits it. But it's a 21-minute short film about a sitcom family that is dragged through alternate dimensions after a car crash while they're on vacation. So it sounds like...
relatable.
You know, yeah.
Something for everybody.
Exactly. Same, right?
Is there a laugh track?
There is.
You're kidding me.
It's a sitcom. It's a straight up just my version of a sitcom.
So it's the Partridge Family by way of...
Rick and Morty?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
it's like juxtaposed, I think, with like 50 different things that are on my brain. So a lot of it was kind of just... What will this all look like in the end? So
just get it out.
Just get it out, and we'll see. And I dig it. I was trying to see if I made it with the mindset of being the most pretentious person possible. I think I would get something funny and enjoyable.
Very
so nice. It's just made in that vein.
So when did you start with this idea? When did you start writing?
Oh, I was in Colorado like 2 years ago, and then I was hanging out, doing what you do in Colorado, like on the mountains, and I was like,
"What do you mean?"
Playing with the animals,
right? No. Yeah.
Taking in the John air. Denver, you know.
I was riding a deer down the mountain, and
as you do,
Wolf blew out,
and just thought of like 50 things at once, and was like, "All right, I'll smash these together because it revolves around these mountain locations I have," and so. Just shooting what was around me just became, I don't know, the thread for Dave ended up being in a scene where we ended up finishing everything besides outside in my living room. So we think that we might try to do like a bi-monthly living room film and just see what we come up with. So, yeah.
I like that. That's a genre.
Right?
The yeah. living room film.
How delightfully Dogma 95 are you?
Well, when I was in college, I made a shot-for-shot remake of Natalie Imbruglia's Torn.
Yes.
But she's taken it down a bunch and then threatened legal action last year. Like paperwork in the mail legal action. So.
Wow. That is assist legal action. Look
yeah.
at that.
That's
you
great.
Must be flattered. Yeah.
I was.
That's an accomplishment.
I was. We linked it to her on YouTube, and I guess she actually saw it.
She's like actively fighting against relevance right now.
I know. And I thought it was pretty good. It was a dedication. But I look awful. I play her on it.
So. Oh.
She may
okay.
have taken it the wrong way.
Okay.
I can understand. I mean, that's all right, yeah. though. I think there's a level of artistic merit that is misunderstood when doing remakes or like homages. I feel like that's, you know, something saying I like this a lot, let me do a version of it. That's too bad that she would take exception to that. With the year 4000, this idea of the sitcom family, and you just mentioned there is a laugh track in it, so it's yeah. very understanding of itself. What were the sitcom influences on this?
Oh, so like I think where a lot of this stemmed from is the past couple of years I've done a lot of like hate watching, so like wasting hours watching the shows I don't like.
Ooh.
And through that, I get this nihilistic expression. So it's like walking in the room and finally seeing like Big Bang Theory and being like,
oh, God.
This is what people like. And I mean, that sounds really mean, but it's just,
what,
it's not my thing.
Watch?
Yeah, exactly. I'm such at like the other realm of it, understanding it, that I was trying to understand it. And so I think that it's like playing an homage to Big Bang Theory, but just with every amount of like disgust that I have when I hear Bazinga.
Did you ever think that you would maybe not put a laugh track in? Because I don't know if you've seen those edited videos on YouTube, like the Big Bang Theory without laughter.
Oh, it's
I
dark.
Love those.
And it's really scary.
It's so good. Yeah. I originally wasn't going to, but I feel like when I'm not doing like comedy stuff, some of my other movies are like horror ones and they're such bummers. And all of my friends and crew were just like, just put a laugh, make it somewhat acceptable.
Tell us how to feel.
People. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're like, put something in. They're like, your last one was such a bummer. In a good way for them, but still.
I thought it was funny.
Yeah, it had comedy in it. You just, different types.
Did you find yourself laughing at it before the laugh track?
Oh, I haven't seen the new film. I
oh.
just mean his last
oh,
horror
yeah.
film.
Oh,
I thought it was
gotcha,
hilarious.
Gotcha.
So you're moving from, would you call the year 4000 a comedy? Is just a left turn from your usual horror?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that it's just, for me, it's just really funny. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was almost like painting an abstract image that makes only you laugh. And so a lot of it was just building this thing. And I'm just really excited to see what anyone's reaction is. Because I think it's the first thing that I've made where I've already showed a couple people, and like my girlfriend had an interesting opinion of it,
yes.
and a couple of friends like, what is this? And I think when you make something and you're so honed into it, even if it is goofy and nonsense, I'm able to just kind of love every opinion of it. So even if someone hates it, it's come from a place of hate, like Big Bang Theory, but at the same time, I'm crafting it with some love. So it's very interesting. A lot more mixed emotions with a piece as silly as this than just doing a horror film.
Where do you try to find the comedy in this kind of bitter look. I don't know, because it's we've seen The Big Bang Theory. I feel like everyone's seen some. You've never seen it, Spence?
Not a single moment.
Consider
yourself.
You're going to be okay. You're going to be okay.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not even by virtue of me disliking that genre. I don't watch a lot of sitcoms in general.
Sure.
Currently, it's just not really a part of my thing, but. I don't know. Whenever I hear stuff about it, and you can, you've got a lot of vitriol to spew at that particular thing. But, I when something is crafted so heavily at, kind of aiming at your geek chakra, I'm always a little wary of it, because most of the stuff, like, I don't know how many geeks we got in the room, comic book people, Dungeons and Dragons people, et cetera.
I think, for sure. Yeah.
The stuff that is made in those realms, from your Star Trek to your Doctor Who to your Rick and Morty's and all that stuff, it's made with a lot of love and an earnest kind of appreciation for whatever the storytelling craft is. So when things come out that are like more of a response to that.
Like ironic.
Yeah.
It's like an impersonation.
It feels a bit disingenuous, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So for that reason, I haven't been attracted to the show.
Yeah.
Sounds like I'm not going to get a lot of glowing endorsements.
No.
But if, probably going to love Dustin's film. Right.
So I like this idea of the traveling through alternate dimensions. Like, that's really why put the sitcom family hurtling through alternate dimensions?
So I can tease a little bit more. None of this is really laid out, but the motivation for a lot of the imagery was this guy's in an accident, the only way to help him from this brain hemorrhage that he has is this just nameless piece of technology from TechCorp, something as generic as that. And he has this chip in his head, and while he's recuperating at home, he's watching TV. So things that he sees become manifest and affect just normal things that you see in any sitcom. So the long form idea of this is something that's like 6 episodes, but where this film is just going to cover how to help your daughter date, should she date, et cetera. So it's about just tackling something that would be in a sitcom, but doing it under the guise of this person taking in these television signals that are manifesting these dimensions around him.
Oh,
so
it's like a morality tale, sort of.
Yeah, yeah,
cool.
Exactly.
I like the meta commentary of having a sitcom family watching TV and being like televisionized. I don't know what the word would be, like this prototypical, television family watching television and then becoming even more stereotypically sick. Damn.
There's kind of a Matryoshka doll of themes there.
Putting a hat on a hat.
Yeah, sort of in the same vein of Tom's question, I was curious, is that like concerted like commentary on sitcoms? Because I feel like a big part of a sitcom to the general audience is like the comfortability with the setting, Like people, you go to the school and you've been there a million times, or you come home to their home a million times. But was that like a concerted effort on your part?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Because like I said, I tried making it as pretentious as possible. So I sat down and I was like asking my friends, I was like, ask me just all these stupid questions. And I was showing like art I was drawing for some ideas and trying to come up with justification legitimate for everything. Because even if it doesn't come across, it's like in the bones of the piece, I feel like.
Sure. So it's kind of maybe not retroactive, but working backwards from the sense that you have something and then you have to explain it. It seems like a real raw creativity, like let's get all these things and make it work.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that was part of the fun and the drive of like, all right, let's make this in a month before the screening, because a lot of it was like that. Was just like, all right, let's make a wastelander sci-fi outfit out of garbage. And yeah, all the costumes are fair trade and recyclable. And that's a marketing point.
Fair trade costumes. Right. Next generation.
What's it like working on that kind of tight of a schedule?
Oh, I like it because it forces me to do stuff, and it forces me to make decisions and stick with them. And I feel like the only way I can grow at this point, because I've gotten to a point where I feel comfortable in my aesthetic and what I want to make, but I kind of need those things to be like an invisible teacher, like forcing me to do something, because you'll trip up and then find something new. And I don't know. I've been forcing these things on me, kind of like lessons to grow in some capacity.
Yeah, the art of restriction seems to be very helpful in a lot of ways to make something that is a little bit risky. I mean, just from the description of this and the fact that you're putting it inside of a month. You said you gave yourself a month to basically make this movie. Do you like being a little bit more risky and being like, maybe we don't plan this out so much, and maybe we don't, you know, have everything down to the Kubrickian detail and just kind of let it flow?
Yeah, I feel like whenever, it's like my past feature, you know, I had a budget for it. And for things like this that are just kind of going to be something that's free online, something I want to just push out and give, those are the projects I like to put the restrictions on. Because if my aim is just to put something free out there and connect with people, I'm not going to like destroy any of my opportunities at making more projects by throwing all my money in. So I try to just make something from just the heart, like, all right, here's something, take it and throw it out.
Mm-hmm. It's like a palate cleanser before your next big project.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
So with Ready Freddy Films, when did you decide I'm going to form this production company or just this name to be under? When did you decide that was what you wanted to do?
Oh, I did it. I first thought of the name the year I graduated in 2009 and then made a movie like this STD horror film. And then it didn't go over well because it's like the first movie efforts. Mm-hmm. I still have it. No one will ever see it unless they're just hanging out with me. But it was through that process, like connected like 10 other great people and then just moved forward from there. So the name's been around a while, but we haven't really started doing dedicated stuff with a rollout until like probably 3 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Can we talk a little more about the STD film?
Yeah, yeah, short-term disability.
Kind of reminds me of It Follows, right? Sort of in that vein.
Yeah, it was called Spots, and it was about this like.
So, excuse me, I just for our listeners, really quick. By STD, you do mean short-term disability, right?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, it's an insurance-based horror film.
Exactly. You've never seen anything like it.
Yeah,
that's why no one will see it. It didn't do good.
The mounds of paperwork.
Yes.
Oh God.
The horror.
Spots. That's great.
So give us the synopsis. What is Spots about?
It's about like this 17-year-old gonna turn 18, going into college. This nerdy wreck who is trying at his core just to get laid, and he takes to avenue like Craigslist and ends up hooking up with someone. And every time he gets sexual urges, he gets these like pus-filled spots that appear all over his body. Mm. So a lot of the movie is it dove into body horror heavily. And at the same time, someone actually starts liking him. So then he has to combat while actually having this affections for this newer person and gives it to them. And then it all starts spiraling out.
Wow. So, can I see this? Yeah. Can you like, I'll give you
password
my
protected.
Yeah. That almost sounds like what if Cronenberg decided to do like a after school special.
Yeah. Right. This is your body on sex.
And I wanted to see, so a lot of filmmakers do start out in that horror genre because it's very easy to do a lot of fun things in a short period of time, low budget, mm-hmm. and and it gives you all the experience that you want. Are there any genres that you really want to work in the future, or do you want to stick to like horror, maybe some comedy in here with the year 4000?
I love writing so much, so I pretty much find value out of most genres, and I feel like the only aim to make money off it is so I could do an action movie, because I love like martial arts movies, but that I need some money to do that. I can't really do a low budget version of that, but that's the A goal.
To get up to that action genre.
A kung fu action genre.
It'd be kung fu, and it would have to have some actors that are actually dedicated and it's some time and effort, but like I don't know, there's not very many good action movies out, and I just appreciate the old school skill, and it's one of those things that would be so awesome to do.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, how do you feel about the like John Wick movies and this kind of turn into that sort of thing?
Yeah, I dig those. I dig those a lot. I feel like there isn't what that movie lacks for me, and it's coming from someone who does like it. Is I still not seeing like an action filmmaker that is like mainstream that has their own like aesthetic. Like John Wick is cool, the choreography is awesome, and it has independent neat qualities to it, but like I just didn't get like an overall like like it sounds lame, but like Michael Bay has his own aesthetic. Like I don't like
You know, a Michael Bay is a genre unto himself.
Yes,
it doesn't matter what he's working in. Like Pearl Harbor and Transformers are the same thing in terms of genre. Sure. No, that's very interesting, and I think there is something to be said about that, especially as we are starting to get, I guess what you could call John Wick clones, Atomic Blonde. As much as I enjoyed parts of that and a lot, like you said, choreography, and it did look cool, had that nice 80s thing, but I didn't feel like it had a real stamp on it. I know Proud Mary with Taraji P. Henson is coming out. I have high hopes for that because I love Taraji P. Henson.
I have high hopes too, but it has this sort of look where it also, like you were talking about, it seems to lack its own kind of personal aesthetic.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, I remember The Raid, you know, had that kind of very particular look and feel to it, and I don't know where the filmmaker, like where that lies with John Wick in terms of the timeline, you know, like what came first or that, but it certainly feels like a lot of things kind of come from that wellspring. Or what's the Selma Hayek movie? Oh goodness, it's
Frida.
Yes, Frida.
The bus scene you're thinking of.
Totally. Now there's a movie that's like The Raid, sort of inverted, that stars Selma Hayek, where she like a bunch, like instead of having to like beat your way into a building, she has to like survive in a single room in a building with guns and all sorts of weird stuff going on around her, and it looks like I might be the only person.
Yeah, I've never heard that one.
Yeah, I'm blanking.
Maybe this is like a screenplay idea that you have.
I dreamed it.
Were you definitely awake?
Yeah, I was definitely awake, and for the life of me, I can't recall the name of the movie. I'm going to say it at random when we're like on an entirely different subject, and everyone's going to be like, what?
We'll get to it. We'll cut around.
Engineer, can we fix that in post?
Yeah, please? And then we'll play our...
we'll put it here so that you seem like you have a really great memory.
Totally.
We'll insert a callback graphic at that point.
Ooh, cool.
I wanted to ask, Dustin, you said that you're going to be releasing the Year 4000 for free. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's just going to be up on YouTube?
I put most of my stuff on Vimeo.
Vimeo's a great platform.
Yeah, just because, like, I just hate the resolution. Ad stuff and the resolution. Yeah, all the obvious stuff, but, like, I just hate the ad thing. Like, that's out the gate. Yeah. But, yeah, no, I like I try to fulfill if you go to readyfreddyfilms.com, there's lots of like free stuff that we've already put up, so we try to every like 6 months like put some free content on and you know, put some quality in it too, so
And they often make their own commercial breaks within their films.
Yeah, we did start making some new commercials in the same like nihilistic vein that the Year 4000's done in. So we did like a fancy feast and like a hoarder like waking up.
What was the Audi one? Was my favorite.
Oh, I love the Audi one.
Sweet.
So you can check that all out over. Check out Ready Freddy Films. You guys are on Facebook, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Ready Freddy Films on Facebook. I wanted to. One more question. In this idea of, you know, putting things up for free on Vimeo, I feel like we're reaching kind of an interesting place in movie distribution or even, you know, TV distribution. Obviously, we've gotten to this Netflix hump and everybody's got their own streaming service and everything like that. Less people are going to actual theaters. Being a filmmaker at this particular level, is it better to put these things up so people can just see them and become interested? Or at what point does financing come into that, being like, okay, I can do one for you guys, but I got to do another one for me that you might need to rent on Amazon Prime?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I try to find a balance with those. So anything that goes free online, which we have a free feature up and we have another full feature that'll be coming up soon. Those only cost me, one of them cost me like $800 and the most recent one cost me like $2,000. So it's not really that bad of like an expensive business card. I mean, so I feel like I only put up something there that I'm proud of. But those, I think you just kind of have to do that at this point, because if you're aiming for a realistic level, like I mean, I could just tell someone like, hey, give me $150,000 and we could do a movie. And I think shooting in that area right now is a nice sweet spot to retain control of it and kind of do what you want.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll move on and start talking about this brand new feature coming from Soft Cage Films, Mandala. It's the third in this anthology that they've been working on over at Soft Cage. Fantastic stuff. Back in just a bit here on No Coast Cinema. Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago.
Once that bell drops, oh.
Chills every fucking time.
I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're very happy to have you again back for this this episode that we're having so much fun on. This has been really enjoyable so far. I hope you're having as much fun as we are. Joined today by Reverend David Holcomb and Spence Warren from Softcage Films. And Dustin Pueller from Ready Freddy Films. Some of my favorite people in the Chicago film scene. And so glad they could join us. They have a huge event that just happened. At the time of recording, it's happening tonight. When you're listening to this, it will have already happened. They're premiering three fantastic films: Down the Rabbit Hole, The Year 4000, and Mandala. We talked a little bit with Dustin about The Year 4000, and I want to get into Mandala in just a second here. But first, I want to say congratulations to Spence Warren for joining Softcage Films as a board member.
Thank you. When I talked to David, David and I had a conversation. It was a very intimate conversation by cell phone. And it was a few days after we had wrapped on a film that I was directing, am directing. We're still in post on it. And he said, "Hey, man, I really like the way you run a set. It's pretty cool, man. And we're trying to do stuff here. We're trying to grow. We're trying to be big, be groovy." Those aren't the exact words to use, but, you know.
Groovy is Spence's word.
That's kind of the way that I remember. Whenever people talk to me, the way that I remember it is, "Hey, man, we're just trying to do stuff and be groovy." And
you remember it in your voice?
Yeah, I remember it in that voice. And I was like, "Dave, I have the very reverend." Can we call him the very reverend?
Yeah,
David
sure.
Holcomb?
Very merry reverend.
You know, I was like, "Rev," I don't call him that, but I will now. "I've never sat on the board of anything, like ever. You sure about this?" And he's like, "I'm sure about this." So then we did the board meeting, and the rest is history. Oh, man.
Because none of us have sat in a board either, so we're all kind of figuring it out.
Just figuring it out, man.
We've never worked construction, never sat in a board. So many things that we haven't done.
Yeah.
Never, you know, been to space.
Yeah.
Never.
But if I invited you.
Would I go? Yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
So what are some of your duties as being part of the board for Softcage Films? I know it's a non-for-profit.
Yes, you know, that's one of your duties.
That's funny.
Let me take notes.
I feel like, I feel like I was able to glean, like, part of my, because the meeting was as much for me to see if this is the right fit for me as it was for them to see if I'm the right fit for them. And I was able to glean that all of our duties are to be vigilant on each of the projects that we're all making and to bring as many resources to bear as we can to help to build this thing, to make it larger than it was last year. To be involved in a vision of Chicago filmmaking that is about finding a vision, you know? And I know that that's a weird use of the same word over and over, but it's like I think that there's an opportunity here to engage people in an artistic vision that's not about selling products and about
softcagefilms.com. We got merch up there.
And no, we do not do sales.
But it's not all about
it's a barter system.
But that's not that's not about selling product. That's not about sort of getting people to an empty experience, but rather that's about getting whatever the most creative bit of yourself is out there to share. And there's a lot of different visions, and that wellspring can create some great works, some stuff that people can really unite around and get behind. And I think that that's part of what's made Softcage sort of a celebrated thing in indie small circles around the city. And I think that that's what will continue to help it grow. So ultimately, my responsibility is to be another part of what helps it grow.
And you guys have been growing at a just a fantastic pace, both as a name and also creatively. I know when we originally brought you on, David, well, a while ago, you've been on twice, I believe.
This is the third time.
Yeah, third time you've been on here. And each time I go back and I look at Soft Cage, I'm on the website checking out, and I'm looking back at these, you know, these works I've already seen, and I'm so struck every time about how much you guys have grown, and but also how mature the films are already. Like, okay. Looking back, you're seeing that.
Hope
you know,
they're not too mature.
No. But, like, I mean, these are films that are made with a great amount of care and a great amount of forethought. I mean, I've got the DVD for Graffito, and I'm like, I can't believe that this came out in 2014. I feel like this was made today because it's still so vibrant and so vital. But then you get to Pilgrim and you're like, oh my god, this is even better. 2015 Breaking, oh my god, I keep forgetting how good these are, and you go back and watch them.
Well, I'm really excited for you to see Mandala, because yes. Pilgrim, Breaking, Mandala, those three films go together in that order, so this is the culmination of those stories.
Absolutely. Can you talk real quick about thematically how these stories are grouped together? They're part of an anthology.
Yeah, so we wanted to showcase these overlooked members of our society that perform essential functions. So taxi driver, a nanny, and in this final one, a janitor. So people that we see every day, but we never really look in their faces, and we are chipping away at their livelihood through our use of technology. And we're just sort of exploring who benefits from these things. You know, the customer, the corporations, the workers, the politicians, and sort of trying to weave that all together into this story that takes place in the here and now, and hopefully...
we'll cut that. Sorry, you were going on. We just had to.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Just,
that was their version of.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about it.
No, I
lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. Oh my god, what a gaffe! What I was trying to do is I wanted to play a little from the Mandala trailer that you have up on
cool.
on Soft Cage Films,
yeah.
just to give
hey.
People a little bit of a
context.
A little bit of a primer on what they will be able to see.
There it is, yeah. So shout out to John Sutton. He's our composer. He did Graffito, and he's done these last three films. We love custom soundtracks for all of our films, going into the studio once the film's complete and throwing it up on the wall and running
right.
through scenes. And then at the end, giving the musicians a chance to just improvise as we run the film, you know, from top to bottom, and just let them kind of feel it out. And then we end up kind of mixing all that stuff together. So try to, much as we shoot our films, trying to, like, really embrace certain elements of chaos and improvisation.
And
but
you can even hear it. Listen.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So John That's, Sutton composed that, and he also helped write it with Heather Mingo, who you guys have worked with throughout, since what, Yellow? Is that right? Or
so
City of Lust?
Yellow I wrote with a couple of scenes written by some friends of mine that are playwrights, but they came aboard on Graffito. Yeah, that
okay.
was our first. They moved to New York for a while, so when they moved back, we kind of reconnected.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be a great way to round off this anthology. And I think the whole idea that you guys went for was just great, because, you know, you're making films about, as you said, people that are kind of overlooked by society. I think obviously I have not seen Mandala yet, but my favorite thus far has been Pilgrim. Like,
cool.
I just love Pilgrim so much. The look of it, the idea of the story, and just where it goes. And
the weird genre.
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of take on the ride-sharing thing. Like, what's the name of the company? They're like...
Lasso.
Lasso.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They make some appearances in this new film, too.
Bless.
Nice. I'm so
yeah.
glad they're back. Because
we,
they're
we actually pulled... I don't even know if I should say this, but we pulled the Uber recently had... their CEO had some... He was caught. He was recorded like flipping out on some employee.
Yeah, they've had a lot of problems with their management sort of thing.
So he released this like, you know, sort of a non-apology.
Yeah.
And so we open one of the scenes with the Lasso CEO repeating that word for word in front of this huge crowd. And then at the end, wrapping it all up by going over how profitable the company is and how it's growing and all this great stuff, which is verbatim what this guy said.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I may have freaked out and I need to address those kinds of things, but we're, you know, up to whatever billion rides a year, and under my leadership, all this great stuff has happened. So can't we just sort of sweep this under the rug and move on?
Oh, my God.
And then does the main character from Mandala come in and actually start sweeping things under the rug?
I'm not going to give it away.
No, okay.
This one gets very surreal and slightly spiritual and has elements of horror. So I'm really interested to see how all these films kind of fit together, because my plan is to take the three films, intercut the first two so that they build to the third and then make that a feature film.
Really?
And already – last night I was just having this discussion with Heather, one of our writers. There were things that I had totally forgotten, because we made Pilgrim 3 years ago, and there's certain characters that reoccur or actors that we reused in different roles that now I was, you know, I had a moment of panic thinking, oh God, that doesn't really work, but then it does work in a very, very strange, bizarre way. So I'm interested to see how these things like these ideas start to come out that maybe we hadn't anticipated, but because the concept was so focused that it's inevitable that it'll just work, you know?
That is a fascinating way to kind of recontextualize the art, though, because they work individually as a self-contained thing with their own themes. But it's funny that you would look back and you're just – when you're just like, okay, let's see if we can cut it together and see how these things speak to each other.
Just as one example, in the story of Breaking, we introduced this character of the mayor, and she's married to a woman who is a model. And so like their home is covered in these like high fashion photo shoots, and she's very high strung, and we kind of explore her character even further in Mandala. And then last night I was putting up information about the film on IMDb, and I realized, oh, the actress that played this model, she was actually in Pilgrim, and I had totally forgotten. She plays like one of these promotional models that's at a bar handing out like free rideshare passes. And then I was thinking, wait, no, that works, because it's actually a little sadder that the mayor didn't end up marrying like a high art fashion model, but she married like a promotional model. So it's like the stature and the weight of that, you know, type of personality is even brought down further because of the way we set it up in the first one without even knowing it.
That's wild. That's wild. And since you started this, and this being both the anthology and Soft Cage Films, you've been doing this for a number of years now and making these films over that time. I'll throw this out to everybody here, because you guys have been all doing this for a little while. How has the Chicago film community changed over time as you've been doing this, both your role in it and also just the overall community? What have you seen grow, change, fall away from it over this this number of years?
I think that we're getting more attention due to the big Dick Wolf shows. Can I say that on air?
Yeah.
We'll beep it.
I did think for a second, I'm like, who's Dick Wolf? Is that a DJ?
When you use the word big in such close succession, that's where we have a problem.
Yeah, okay. So Little Dick Wolf Productions.
Producer of Chicago Dick.
Yeah. Chicago Dick. I think it's really like forced filmmakers to sort of embrace a different, you know, a vision or an aesthetic that's uniquely ours, because we see someone that's kind of associated with New York coming in and trying to make shows that take place in Chicago but don't feel very Chicago, and sort of exploit certain issues without having that firsthand experience or dealing with them in a nuanced way. And while people are getting a lot of work, I've heard horror stories just about the process, and people that I really connect with, like Spence and Dustin, it's because I see the process and I'm like, that's how I want to make films. And let's focus on making them a certain way. And then we just have to trust that the end result is going to be something that's very intentional. Because I don't think you can make something beautiful and profound and that's going to last forever if the process is just ugly and damaging and not respectful.
Very much
and
so.
Not fun. It's got to be fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, there's this thing, right? Like when you're working on big movies or commercials, like my bread and butter job is I work as a art director on commercials mostly, but I also worked in some TV. And you know, the thing that we sort of accept as film workers is that there's going to be a modicum of misery with every job yeah. you do. And sometimes that misery is compounded, and a lot of folks just say, well, it's just the business, you know. It's and really it's the way that people do the business. You know,
it's individuals.
There are some jobs, like, you know, Steven Soderbergh was in town a few years ago, one of my first art department jobs, doing a movie called Contagion. And I mean, the experience of working on it was pretty easy breezy for most people on the production. Like, you know, we were shooting for like 6 hours some days, and like, you know, the office environment was generally pretty friendly and nice. So it's like, you know, this is a big movie with a bunch of movie stars in it. So
do you think he set that tone and just kind of?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that it always comes from the top. When directors, I've worked on other productions that I won't name, where the directors were not nice people. And it always trickles down. You're always in situations where there's high stress environments because directors and or producers are tyrants. And they place this really strong importance on immediacy. You know,
I have this thing, too.
I want it right now, and if you don't give it to me, then you're a liability. And that's just trickles through all the departments. So,
whoa.
You know, we can make movies. We can make movies better than that, and we can create circumstances like we were talking about. You know, and we talked about a lot on that shoot. This idea that there's that movie, and if you've ever been to like film school, you know, and been to a film festival, you've seen that movie where it's like there's a guy with a beard in a bathtub and it's a long shot and he's
so far
crying.
It sounds like Dustin.
Yeah, yeah. That's like four of my movies.
But it's just he's there and he's just crying for like 5 minutes, and then he walks into some rooms and sighs, turns off and on lights, and then goes into another room and does some more sighing and or crying.
But it's not a comedy.
And then it's back to the bathtub.
Yeah. And then now he's in the bedroom and he picks up a phone.
Rinse and repeat.
He starts arguing with someone that we don't see or hear. And then he hangs up the phone, and then we hold on like another 3 or 4 minutes of him sobbing in the bed, and then fade to black. And it's like, you know,
sounds really good.
That's it's miserable to work on those movies.
Good, because we're raising $150,000 right now
to make that movie. You know, I mean, it's just and nothing against people who want to make that movie. It's just that, you know, I think that you have to kind of earn your way to it.
Yeah.
You know, for the time that we're like asking people to come out and work either for very little money or for free or whatever. Like, I think it's kind of our job to make fun movies, like stuff that people can kind of get behind artistically. So, you know, working on Breaking, that was the first project that Dave and I did together. I did a little bit of pinch hit art direction for it. You know, pinch hit prop mastering probably would be a more proper
pinch hit prop. I wish
there.
I'd put that in the credits now.
You should have.
Pinch hit prop master.
You know,
not allowed in the National League.
No. I was definitely a minor league pinch hit prop master on that. But yeah, you know, I mean, it was there's this sense of like a really, really strong politique with this movie and a really, really strong sort of artful personal vision that so many of the people who had been working on it shared. And that's something that is just it's contagious. You know, you feel it. You know, I imagine that was true on this movie that you're talking about, where, you know, you're out there in the mountains and you're coming up with this.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you have a duty at our level to make it fun for everybody, because I mean, I don't know. I look at everything that I make as just a conversation you're having. Like, here's some silly stuff. Here's some ideas. And the movie about the sad guy who's crying, like, we've all had that conversation in our daily lives a whole bunch. So unless it's something new and unique and original, and I feel like that, yeah, you have to have that driving force at our level. Or else people are going to get bored.
Yeah.
So have all three of you, Spencer, you have all three of you guys worked in not necessarily like film projects outside of the independent film scene?
Yeah.
So would you say that commitment to fun, I guess, or just like passion, would you say that you'd found that in more large productions, or is it something that's kind of inherent to the independent film scene?
It depends on the movie.
Sure.
Depends on the commercial. I don't know if it's cool to say people's okay, well, you know what? When you say something positive, it's okay to say people's names. So there's some local filmmakers. They're called the Norman Brothers, and I've worked with them a couple times. They're remarkably creative, very generous, very smart. They're a directing duo, which sometimes can be a very difficult thing to deal with. But in their case, it's like you can talk to one, talk to the other, and their visions are always intertwined and you're getting new information. It's great. So, you know, in situations like that, there's all sorts of fun to be had, even when it's, you know, you're selling shoes or soft drinks or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I think it's just putting ego aside. Like, I've worked on some bigger film shoots in Chicago where producers and directors came in from L.A., but the below-the-line people were all from Chicago. And so without having to go to L.A. and try to get on a shoot, I was sort of able to see, like, the stark difference in the philosophy and just basically confirmed my conviction that this is the place for me and how – I think that with all that's happening in L.A., you know, with the harassment and the toxic power structures, I feel like we have an opportunity to build something from the bottom up with a whole new set of values. And so that's what I'm really excited about, is finding people that are so focused on, like you said, you know, my job as a director is to sort of like craft this atmosphere. It's kind of an abstract thing. We were talking about this a lot. That's why I really connected with Spence on his set, because at our level now, with a lot of exceptions, we're not always the person holding the camera or, like, you know, slating or doing a whole lot of hands-on tangible stuff that literally ends up on screen. So our job is more to, like, take every person's idea, recognize what the best one is, and say, okay, this is the new game plan. We're all going to start running, you know, with this vision and making sure we're all telling the same story, but not all the ideas have to be mine and not all of my ideas are the best. And if you poke a hole in my idea, I'm certainly happy to take your idea and adapt it so that it fits into our story. It's not necessarily directing by committee, but it's definitely like a clear vision that we're constantly re-editing. But kind of going back to what Spence was saying earlier about the board, I think that was a big reason that I wanted to bring him on, too, is just to keep us honest and keep our integrity in terms of, like, our vision and our mission statement and what we're trying to do, so that that always comes first. And then making the most exciting, bold, artistic decisions, because we're a nonprofit. Like, it's great. We don't have to, you know, make money. We don't have to, like, please our investors. There's no producer telling me, oh, you can't do that. You know, if it is in line with our values and our mission statement, then yeah, hell yeah, we can do it. And we're going to be as ambitious as and try to bring in as many fireworks as we possibly can for each production, even if it is dark. I mean, you're talking about a guy sitting alone in a hotel room, and instantly I'm like, oh, I've got like 100 ideas about where this could go, you know? And that was just like a lack of ideas, not like that story doesn't work or that, you know, emotion of loneliness and isolation doesn't work. Yeah. It's just that we're used to creating an illusion. So if you want to do something slow, you can create that illusion without it actually literally being slow. It can still feel slow without it being actually slow.
It's like proper regard for audience engagement, I think, is something that a lot of us like, I am one of very few people who do what we do and who work in this business that I know anyway, who is like a staunch proponent of film school. I think it's a great idea. If it is within you to do it, go to do it, because there is the best place to sow your creative wild oats and make that movie that we just talked about, where you're, you know, where there's no regard for that.
Get all the mistakes out of your system.
Get that out of your system, and then you can craft, if you want to make that film in the future, you craft the version of it that can actually invite your audience in. You know, to learn who your characters are and to connect with the story in some way, form, or fashion.
Reminds me of a Blues Traveler song called The Hook.
Yeah, The Hook Will Bring You Down.
Wow, I've heard Blues Traveler brought up, be like, man, you know what? This really reminds me of a Blues Traveler song.
Something.
Let me,
everybody's quiet for a second and be like, wow.
Yeah, Blues Traveler.
You know, Blues.
John Popper, man.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
The Bard, I think they call him.
The Bard.
Wow. You guys have given us a lot to chew on. Like, yeah. Both Blues Traveler and let's be honest here. That everything you guys said is part of the reason that the Chicago film community is so important right now. And especially like thinking about like this idea of someone like Dick Wolf, who thinks that he can just come in here and be like, oh, if we mention deep dish pizza, then they'll know we're in Chicago. And that's not to disparage this. I do appreciate this idea of having bigger productions coming into the city and bringing work for people, you know, people who can be extras, people who can work on the set in the behind the scenes roles. That's super important. And I like this idea that Chicago is being more recognized as somewhere where we can make movies on a large scale.
Yeah, like all my friends are getting their SAG cards finally. It's
right.
Pretty cool.
That's great that they're able to do that. However, I do fear that it will kind of stamp down the real heart of what's happening in Chicago and the identity of Chicago, which is being represented.
I just thought of this when I was in Spain like 3 years ago shooting a documentary. We were invited into a family's house and we were about to have dinner, and the TV was on, and they like pointed at the TV and looked at me like, did you see what we did? And they had like Chicago PD or something on there, or Chicago Fire. And they're like, from Chicago, like you. And we're just like, okay, how do we explain the difference between that and Chicago? So that's my biggest worry about this stuff is that, like, I know it's not us, but then other people see it and they're like, oh, that's them.
Yeah, there's the Prudential Building. Like, it must be Chicago.
That's how it is to live there. It's chaos and fires and drug dealers. And
it's cheap imitation, kind of.
Yeah, and it's exploiting whatever issues we have in a not very nuanced way.
Yeah, I think that's important, is the nuance, how we represent ourselves to people in a way that's not coated over by NBC execs and being, you know, celebrating the highs, the lows, and the in-betweens of this fantastic city. If you guys can stick around for just a little bit, I want to just briefly talk about what we've been watching recently, if that sounds cool with you.
Word.
All right. Soft Cage Films, Reverend David Holcomb and Spence Warren, and Ready Freddy Films, Mr. Dustin Bueller. Thank you so much for talking about your films with us, and hopefully, you know, good luck at this. You know, great premiere that you guys are going to have tonight. There's burlesque.
Oh, yeah.
There's music.
Stand-up comedy. Three films.
Ready Freddy Films will be doing the burlesque, correct?
Yeah. All the burlesques.
Very excited for that.
So, as I said, as we're recording, this is happening tonight, but hopefully you already knew about it. Hopefully you were there. And, you know,
having had been there
in the future.
Smashing
listener.
Success.
Thousands of years ago.
All right. Be back in just a second on NoCo Cinema. All right, everybody. Time for our last little segment here on NoCo Cinema. This is something that we've done for the last couple episodes that I really enjoy. I really like doing this because it gives us a chance to just talk about wider what we're watching, what we're really interested in the film world. I'm going to be talking a little bit about what we've been watching on streaming, DVD, Blu-ray, whatever. What's keeping us interested right now. We're going to go around the horn just a little bit with our good friends, David Holcomb, Spence Warren, Dustin Bueller.
Yay.
Who've been joining us. Thank you so much again for being on the show. Just real quick, give me basically one thing that you've been watching recently that has really captured your attention, or you saw maybe a screening of something. What did you like about it? Why would you recommend it? That sort of thing. So give us a recommendation, Mr. Reverend David Holcomb.
I've got to say, Endless Poetry. I saw it at the Gene Siskel by Alejandro Jodorowsky, his new film.
Oh, yes.
Man, I am sure people just get tired of me talking about this guy, but he's 88 years old. He just made a feature film. He says it's the first of a 5-part feature film series.
Wow.
That's like part of his autobiography, I guess. And it's the best thing I think he's ever done. And I can't imagine doing something at that level at that age. It's just such an inspiration.
That's wild.
It's just so beautiful.
He's 88?
Yeah.
And he still hasn't made Dune. I think that's the greatest.
Oh, it's made. It's a comic in his house. He has one copy that he can never release. Have you saw the documentary about it?
I know it exists, but I've always wanted to see it because I'm just like, man, like... That's the most fascinating thing I've ever heard, that this guy was going to make Dune and it was going to be great, and then it just didn't happen.
I think he did like a frame-by-frame comic full color with Meebus, his longtime comic book illustration partner. And so in the documentary, you see him like inviting people over to his house, and he's like, let's watch Dune. And they sit down on the couch, and they just go through it page by page.
and he's made it, you know?
So it exists.
So what is Endless Poetry, just briefly, what's the gist of it?
It's covering the period of his life from very early age up until about, I would say, it seems like 17 or 18, and he sort of leaves home and gets on a ship to go to Europe. So I think from there we can assume that the next phase is going to be his like life in Paris and becoming a part of this theater movement. I don't know how much you know, but he started this theater movement with Fernando Arrabal. And so this part was sort of his introduction to like finding himself as a poet. You know, his parents clearly wanted him to be, I believe it was like a doctor or a lawyer or something.
Sure.
And it's one of those things where there's so many scenes where you can see it heading towards something and you're like, oh, no, 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 stop. And then he does something where you're just like, okay, all right, wow. Somehow you spun that into something profound. There's so many silly decisions that end up at the end really paying off. Like this simple example is his mother in the film. She's the only person in the entire movie that doesn't speak. All of her lines, she sings as like an opera singer.
Wow.
And it's at first the entire, like every time she opens her mouth, everyone in the theater is like rolling with laughter. But by the end, because they've set that up, there's moments at the end where you're just like so overwhelmed with emotion because it's working so well.
Wow. Endless Poetry. Alejandro, how do you pronounce his last name?
Jodorowsky.
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 My buddy over on the south side, Jodorowsky.
Iljandro.
Yeah, Iljandro.
All right, Spence, what do you got for us?
Go for me. You know, here's the thing. I am so not dialed in to the scene, man.
Movies?
To anything. I mean, you know, I love stuff, things as well, but I'm never like on the cutting edge, you know, like this is a thing that's happening right now.
Neither am I. That's why I'm so happy I saw a movie last week.
I'm late to the party on freaking everything. So, you know, I don't know. So like, all right, a thing that I love and I feel like I just want to tell every single human being about is this, like, it's a documentary series on Netflix and it's called Hip Hop Evolution. And it is everything that I have been hoping for from every documentary I've ever watched about hip hop. Like, finally someone understands it. You know, I can't remember the filmmaker's name for the life of me, but he himself is an MC. That probably helps. But what it does is it tells the story of hip hop, you know, kind of as it began, and then takes us through this 4-episode journey from like from the streets of New York to California and points in between. And it talks about like the different parts of the evolutionary chain. So it's not just talking heads the way that a lot of those kinds of documentaries are. It's like there's narration, there's little animated bits, and then there's also interviews in various different places that take place largely in the framework of conversations with the gods. Because like one of the really interesting things that we have in hip hop is that most of the people who created it, like as we know it today, like most of the pioneers are still alive. Like that's a resource that no other like big genre in American music has, you know, where all of them, most of them are still with us. So, you know, every time someone kind of misses on that, like there have been some good ones, and I feel like I shouldn't name the other ones because I don't have very nice things to say about them. But, you know, there have been some that have gotten close to hitting the mark and others that have missed the mark wildly. But this one, I think, really gives us like a personal and clear vision of the thing. My only criticism of it is it ends too early. It stops at gangster rap, and then there's no more after that.
Hopefully, well, maybe we can get another one out of it. Like, you know, Ken Burns did the 10th inning for his baseball documentary.
Oh my God. He sure did.
He did. So, and that's the thing is that I've seen this documentary. I've seen the first episode. I've seen the first part, and I definitely agree with the way that it was done was so much more than like just VH1 Behind the Music.
Oh,
like
God.
It felt very, it was so well researched and so well put together that I can only hope that the guy who made it can continue either with this or just do something else completely, because it's very comprehensive.
I would love to hear him talk about MC Hammer.
Oh yeah,
you know, in the context of larger hip hop music,
we can only hope.
I would love to hear him talk about Jay-Z. I would love to hear him talk about Biggie too. But like, I would love to hear him get to that part of the era. That'd be great.
So it stopped at like mid-90s or something?
It stopped at like early 90s, like just right around like when NWA hit. Like,
oh,
that's
wow.
Right around where it stops. Huh. And for reasons that I'm not sure of, like I don't know what the backstory is, I assume that they ran out of money.
They're like, and then you guys know the rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that brings us to now, 20 years later.
So Straight Outta Compton, and now Trap.
And here we are.
And now Trap. And now Skrillex, for some reason.
So get out there and watch Hip Hop Evolution. Thank you so much, Spence. And Dustin, what have you been watching recently? What have you seen recently that has tickled your fancy?
You know, it was really good. I watched, did you guys see American Vandal on Netflix?
Yes.
At all?
No. Surprisingly good.
Oh, so good. Like, I was blown away. Like, I hope a lot of the crew and are the kids. Like, I hope some of the older kids that are in it are some of the creative crew. I haven't looked into it yet, but they blew my mind. The nuance and all of those characters. It's fantastic. And it was 7 episodes. When the first episode finished, and then I was like, oh my gosh, there's 7 more. I appreciate how long they played the joke out.
They really did. And it gets into surprisingly like deep places about like this is literally, so for those who don't know about American Vandal, it's basically a huge joke on like Making a Murderer or like 48 Hours mystery, but it has to do with the kid spray painting dicks on his high school teacher's cars. But it starts out as this joke. I know it was produced in conjunction with like Funny or Die, and that's what, you know, that's where the idea came from. And it goes into surprisingly deep places about like internalization and, as you said, Dustin, biases. Mm-hmm. You know, this kid who gets painted as the bad kid his entire life, you know, being framed essentially for this crime. Not to spoil anything, damn it. So he gets accused of this crime, and it goes into this whole Making a Murderer thing, and it has a lot to say about the nature of documentary, about like when you're making a film about people, how is this like affecting them, how does this like frame their conversations. It's, as you said, it's fantastic.
Oh, it was so good.
And I'll be real with you. And I'm not going to be as you know, kind as Spence when it comes to things. I fucking hate Jimmy Tatro. Like, I don't like him in anything except for this.
Right?
This is like an incredible performance from a guy. He's almost playing the version of himself that everybody thinks he is, just making cock jokes and stuff like that and being a total bonehead. And it has reframed my opinion of Jimmy Tatro. Yeah. So good job, Netflix and all that. Definitely check out American
Shout
Vandal.
Shout out to the Tatro.
The Tate. The Tate.
Come on the show, Tatro.
Yeah,
the
Jimmy Tatro.
The Tate and the Tooch.
The Tooch.
Like, be together. You know, the Tate and the Tooch should be the new Wayne's World. Oh, what God. Do you think?
Throwing my keys.
Connor, what have you watched recently that's really...
So, like a lot of people, I have been riding the third wave of hype surrounding Tommy Wiseau's The Room. Mm-hmm. And
Is it like, really the third wave?
Third wave?
I feel like it came out, and it was terrible, and it got panned, and then it sort of built a cult following, which I imagine it would be like the second wave.
No,
now that the Disaster Artist has come out, it's like the third wave that's bringing the mainstream people in.
I mean, say what you will about Tommy Wiseau as a personality and about that film as a director. Like, how many filmmakers can say that they created something that has become such a cultural phenomenon?
Yeah, it's insane.
I mean, my God.
And that is my favorite part about it, is the cultural phenomenon that is Tommy Wiseau himself.
Yeah.
Like, while I was watching the movie, I had to look up his Wikipedia page and just try to find out, because I'd heard that the movie was made for $6 million, The Room. And nobody knows where the money came from
or where it went.
So I was like, okay, I really want to read as much as I can about this guy.
Wow.
And the Wikipedia I started reading it in his voice because I was watching the movie at the same time. But there's just some truly bizarre lines in that. So it's like I click on the early life page and it says Tommy Wiseau gained early recognition in Europe for his bird toys, which were popular at the time.
What?
And there's no link to the bird toys. There's never mention of
Did
it
Tommy
ever again.
Tommy Wiseau write his own Wikipedia page?
I fucking hope so.
Oh,
I really hope so.
Well, and in a way, he tried to, because we now know he actually has finally admitted that he is not from America.
Yeah.
Like, which is something...
Europe.
Yeah, he's from Europe. He's, like, Polish.
Yeah.
But he...
Welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with him being not from America, but he had this really insane, like, and very interesting... obsession with being the all-American.
Like, he's very adamant about his Americanness.
Right,
and he just lies about it.
He said he was from,
Louisiana. Never believed
just
you, guy.
He kept saying he was from, like, Louisiana, and he really had this dream of becoming the James Dean. He really wanted to go to Hollywood and make this movie that's about, like, you know, how hard it is to be an American. This is Tommy Wiseau's vision of America, is The Room.
And the last thing that I really want to say about this movie
Tommy Wiseau's vision of America.
Is it's based off of a 540 page novel that Tommy Wiseau wrote.
Yes.
He wrote a novel called The Room?
The script of The Room is based off of a 540-page novel.
What?
Yes. Wikipedia, guys. It's an invaluable resource.
Whoa.
Donate now. But the thing that I loved about that movie was the writing. The writing in that movie, I think it's fucking incredible. Like, everything is told squarely from his perspective, except occasionally Lisa and Greg's... Mark and Lisa's characters.
Oh,
but
hi, Mark.
Anytime somebody says something negative about Tommy Wiseau's character, somebody jumps in and defends him immediately.
Yeah. Yes.
It's unreal. Like, there's no...
Oh, right. When the mother and the daughter are having that, like, cyclical conversation that they always have every few minutes.
And they talk
about,
I have breast cancer, and that goes away, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's you're right. He constantly is being justified as being this good guy, and how could you not love him? And why are you cheating on him? And he's just this tragic hero in this almost Grecian sort of like play. It's insane. I love The Room. I think
you'll make a remake.
Oh, I hope not.
You know?
I kind of don't. I don't want them to. I know
like
that
a reboot.
Reboot.
I don't think that you could capture the first 20 minutes of four sex scenes in a row. I don't think that you could ever.
Well, James Franco has apparently like about a half an hour of a shot-for-shot remake of The Room that he did while doing The Disaster Artist. So release the tapes. A24, I will buy that Blu-ray immediately if that's like a special feature.
Keep circulating the tapes, Frankie.
Release the tapes, damn it.
Release the tapes.
That's right.
But yes, The Room and The Disaster Artist, which I hopefully will be able to watch. I'm very interested in it. For me, just real quickly, I finished watching this documentary that I started a while ago, another Netflix documentary called Five Came Back, which is about John Ford, John Huston, Frank Capra, and William Wyler. It's about them being part of the American propaganda machine during World War II and these films they made. And it's a fascinating part of film history because you don't even realize that these guys from Hollywood, the guy who made It's a Wonderful Life was basically in charge of the American propaganda machine, which is weird because I love Frank Capra, and it gives you
a
different
view. Like Goebbels.
Yeah. But the thing is, that's... Frank Capra, our Goebbels.
Our Goebbels.
A life in pictures.
So talented if it just used his forces for good.
Well, that's the weird thing about it. It had me in a conflicted place because, and I think they address it really interestingly because they do talk about how a lot of these American propaganda films are a direct cause of anti-Japanese, you know, serious racism. And, but a lot of these guys, like William Wyler, he got into this because he was Jewish and he knew what was happening, not to the extent that they eventually knew, but he knew that there was this anti-Semitic thing that was going on in Germany, and he thought this is how he can get involved, and everybody was getting involved, and it results in some of the most harrowing filmmaking ever made. Like, you've got John Huston at Dachau. And this is him revealing literally to the entire world what happened. Like, this is the first time, and they showed it at his film at the Nuremberg trials. You've got some really fantastic and important, you know, depictions of war. This is the first time people were really seeing depictions of war, and it changes the entirety of war cinema, and for better or for worse. Because I would recommend the documentary. It's only 3 episodes long. I think each episode is about an hour, and it takes you through the different stages of how they get into the war. You know, shooting D-Day, like being on the beaches, and then kind of the aftermath, and like how did this affect people? And the films they even made depicting what at the time they called battle fatigue, what we know now is PTSD. Some of the earliest depictions of people suffering, you know, soldiers suffering this. So I just find it fascinating in that sense, and gives you an idea of how propaganda functions, both in both from the Axis powers and from us, and how it was both positive and negative in a lot of ways. So
how
definitely
powerful
recommend
that. Film is.
Yeah, that's the thing that always blows my mind, is that whenever you watch movies, especially about World War II, they're just like they talk about the propaganda machine. They're just like, dude, like, you don't even realize how powerful cinema was. And I never knew, because I feel like we're watching movies. Oh, it's just movies. But it reminds us about the power of cinema, how it can influence people. Thank you so much, guys, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
This has been fantastic.
So cool.
Please come back anytime. Reverend David Holcomb, Spence Warren from Soft Gauge Films, and of course Dustin Pueller from Ready Freddy Films. Thank you so much. So much fun every time.
Thanks for having us.
We are No Coast Cinema, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I'm Tom Hush.
I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you next time.